Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. This year's Kristallnacht Remembrance will examine the role of the bystander. This annual memorial, organized by Tulsa's Council for Holocaust Education, remembers the events of Kristallnacht, the night of breaking glass, November 9, 1938, when Nazis in Germany and Austria launched a pogrom against Jews, Jewish-owned businesses, and synagogues. Over 250 synagogues were destroyed, thousands of Jewish-owned businesses, and around 30,000 Jews were arrested and incarcerated. The events were widely reported around the world, but no action or response was taken from the world community. We often hear the adjective innocent paired with the word bystander. But are there innocent bystanders in the face of injustice, discrimination, bigotry, or violence, then or today? My guest is the speaker for Sunday's Kristallnacht Remembrance, Dr. John Roth. He's a professor emeritus of philosophy at Claremont McKenna College. He was the founding director of that school's Center for the Study of Human Rights. He's a noted researcher on the Holocaust and genocide, and he served on the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Council and has received the Distinguished Achievement Award for Holocaust Studies from the Holocaust Educational Foundation. He's the author or editor of over 50 books, and he'll speak on And the World Was Silent virtually via Zoom Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. You can register for the Kristallnacht Remembrance on the events page at jewishtulsa.org. Dr. John Roth is my guest today. Professor Roth, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Rich.
You're going to be speaking at the Kristallnacht Remembrance this Sunday. This time that we remember when the Nazi regime turned against its Jewish citizens. And I want to start with a quote by Albert Einstein. This is a very famous quote. "The world is too dangerous to live in, not because of people who do evil, but because of the people who sit by and let it happen." And that seems to be perhaps a theme of this year's remembrance, is the consequence of being a bystander.
Yes, very much. I think the theme that is being used for the event is the idea that the world was silent while something destructive was taking place. And the bystanders are crucial, and I'm glad we can talk about that idea. I'm going to be using an image. It'll be not literally a picture that people will see, but I'll try to describe it. But the picture shows a group of citizens of an Austrian city in November of 1938, when Kristallnacht took place, and they are watching while a building burns. And the building is a Jewish building in this city, and there are no firefighters around. We don't know how the fire started, but somebody took a picture. And the picture is really not only of the building aflame, but of all the people who are standing there just looking at it. And these people knew that the building was a Jewish facility. There's no question about that, in my mind at least. And they're not doing anything. They're just standing there looking at it in the picture. But of course, these people were coming and going, and they probably weren't actually silent. They were probably speaking about what was happening, and they certainly had been talking before they got there, and they were talking after they left. So they are kind of emblematic of what we might think of as bystanders. They didn't probably set the fire, but they didn't do anything to stop it or prevent it, let alone to put it out. And I think that those people who are watching the building burn are kind of emblematic of what we think of as bystanding during the Nazi period. And it was the vast, vast number of people who simply let something happen that were instrumental in the destruction process.
You know, Primo Levi said in Hitler's Germany, a particular code was widespread. Those who knew did not talk. Those who did not know did not ask questions. And more importantly, those who asked questions received no answers. And I think that's, you know, the bystanding in Nazi Germany. Most people knew something. They knew something. They knew, and oftentimes they knew a lot and said nothing.
Yes, certainly around the Kristallnacht pogroms, these huge riots that took place throughout the Third Reich in early November of 1938, people knew what was going on, and many people participated in the riots themselves. Jewish businesses were targeted, synagogues were burned, people were arrested and beaten. Many people see this as a sort of moment that made it absolutely clear that Jews living under the swastika could never again expect to have a normal life. And the fact that so many people saw what was going on, and if they did not participate in it directly, stood by while the violence was happening, is something that has made Kristallnacht kind of synonymous with the phenomenon of bystanding. A couple of important things I would want to add about the idea of bystanding. I think one of the important things with these categories that we use, and often with the Holocaust, we have a three-part kind of catalog of human behavior. We talk about perpetrators, people who actually did all the bad things. We talk about the victims of those actions, and then bystanders has been a kind of third category that's been conventional in analysis of these things. But I think the thing that's important to see, and it is especially true of the bystander idea, is that these are not static ideas or categories. It's fluid, it's changing. That is, a person could be a bystander and then they might become a perpetrator. Or they might be a bystander and then see what was happening, and then they begin to see something is wrong, and they start doing things that we could call forms of resistance or protest. So it's a category that doesn't suggest some kind of fixed, predestined, fated identity of some kind. It's a fluid notion that allows people to change. You become a bystander, and you can also stop being a bystander. I think this is one of the important things, especially as we think about ways in which Kristallnacht may be a kind of warning for our own times and places. That is, we can be silent, we can stand by while things are happening, but then maybe we become people who intervene and who protest and resist. I mean, this is the potential that's there. A person isn't predestined or fated just to be, you know, in one kind of category that emerges out of a conceptual framework for trying to understand a big dynamic event like Kristallnacht was.
It's interesting, that image that you referred to at the beginning of our conversation, that image is kind of a common image throughout history, as long as there's been photography. In fact, in our own community in Tulsa, 17 years prior to Kristallnacht, there was a pogrom on Memorial Day weekend. We refer to it now as the Tulsa Race Massacre. And that same image that you described is shown in black and white photographs of the time, of people looking from downtown to the African-American community in Greenwood, watching the fires.
Yes, I think this kind of image that you've described and the one that I was describing earlier, these are common images that we get through, you know, photography. Photography, of course, fixes the image, and people aren't moving, they aren't coming and going, but the image can capture the reality that's in fact what was going on. And this is a challenge. This is why it's important to remember an event like Kristallnacht, or in the case of Tulsa, as has recently been the case, to think back about the history there. We often talk about these events as warnings, and they are, and I think particularly in 2021 America, these warnings have a kind of new urgency about them. I mean, we are living in a time and a place in our own country right now where things are happening that should give us pause and make us think twice about what the future holds or what it might hold. And the idea of just being a bystander, not doing anything, staying silent while these things are going on, I think is something that we need to be alert about and to guard against.
Earlier you were talking about the fact that the bystander is a fluid notion. It can move into being aligned with the perpetrator. It can be the motives can align more with the victims and lead to resistance. But there are also some interesting sort of categories that make up the bystander. One that certainly goes along with the theme of "and the world was silent." I'm reminded by something that Justice Felix Frankfurter was confronted by an emissary from Poland who had witnessed some of the atrocities early in the war. And he was told, he says, "I'm a direct witness. The ambassador from exiled Poland was there." And he says, "I can't believe you." And he says, "This is an official government emissary. Are you calling him a liar to your face?" He goes, "No, I'm not calling you a liar. I'm saying I can't believe it." How common is this notion?
Well, I think that if that is a notion that is alive today, it's something that we should fairly quickly disabuse ourselves about, because the notion that we didn't know or don't know what's going on in the world is something that modern technology and communications has pretty well set aside as a plausible kind of excuse for inaction or indifference or silence. Even back in the time that you're referring to with the quotation, I think that the idea that we couldn't believe it was expressing more shock that something like this destructiveness could take place. We know already in the photograph that I alluded to from the Austrian city, I mean, people knew what was happening. I don't think there's much doubt about that. The questions could be asked, how much did they know? But certainly with Kristallnacht, the people who were living in the Third Reich everywhere could see that or could quickly learn that massive destruction had taken place in the country. And today, with the 24-hour news cycles that we have and with the imagery that is kind of besieging us all the time, it's pretty hard to make the excuse that we don't know what's going on. We can kind of be indifferent toward it. We can tune it out. But the excuse that we don't know, I think, is one that puts the burden back on us. It puts the ball back in our court with respect to what our posture and position is with regard to what is happening.
There's another type of bystander as well, and that is the one that is shocked by the methods used, but when you examine their beliefs are more in common with the perpetrator than the victim. We had a guest on not too long ago. Early in his career, he interviewed a German professional. He was shocked and horrified by, as many of the German bystanders claim to be, by the excesses and the murders of the Third Reich. But when he began probing his attitudes towards Jewish people, he had bought into the anti-Semitism, Semitic tropes, and was absolutely, his beliefs were in line with the regime aims.
Yes, it's a very important point. I made the point earlier that the category of bystander is a fluid concept. It's not something fixed. But the other thing that needs to be said is that this behavior that we call bystanding exists in a context. And the point you're making right now is that there are forces at work in a historical event like Kristallnacht, or even in our own time, that encourage bystanding, because the propaganda, you could say, the imagery that is part of the culture in which bystanding takes place often trades in the stereotypes of race or religious prejudice or discrimination of one kind or another. So yes, you're exactly right. Somebody might say, well, you know, these Jews in Austria, they kind of deserve this, so let their building burn. But then other people, even who hold that view, might say, no, this is going too far. We really can't, you know, let people just have arson taking place without any accountability or responsibility attached, and that might affect their attitudes as well. So a lot depends on the context here. where we're talking about the bystanding phenomenon. There are other all sorts of motivations that are behind bystanding. I mean, we have, you can think of the catalog fairly readily. The context makes it different. The prejudice, the dispositions about what's happening to the people who are being the targets of violence plays into this. But things like fear, people won't act because they are afraid of the consequences if they do. There may be things as fundamental as ambition and greed that enter into bystanding. Somebody will say, well, I'm not going to do anything here because my advantage is actually just to let this happen. I may gain from it in some ways. Other people might say, well, I'm not going to do anything because if I tried, it wouldn't make any difference and it'll just cause a whole bunch of problems for me. So the incentives to bystand, to not act, to not intervene, or in the theme of the Kristallnacht observance, to keep quiet. We sometimes use the phrase, well, let's get along by going along. You know, we'll just kind of, you know, let things flow and maybe it'll work out okay for me, even though some other people are getting harmed badly by what's taking place. So the motivations, the incentives that encourage bystanding are many and diverse, and that's part of the problem that has to be dealt with if we want to try to make people less fearful, less likely to just sit it out and let things happen that maybe could be prevented or could be checked if people would take action.
My guest today is John Roth, a professor emeritus of philosophy at Claremont McKenna College. He's a noted ethical philosopher and Holocaust researcher. He'll be the speaker for the Kristallnacht Remembrance, Sunday, November 7th at 2 p.m. via Zoom, on the consequences of being a bystander or And the World Was Silent. And of course, the world was silent in the 1930s, well into the 1940s. I think it's 1943 or maybe even 1944 before the U.S. government acknowledged the Holocaust publicly through Henry Morgenthau. Why the silence, even though there were reports getting out from embassies, from people who escaped, people who had witnessed the horrors firsthand? Why was there such complicity and silence among the world?
This is a fraught topic as far as American responses to the Holocaust as it was happening are concerned. There are debates that swirl around the posture and policies of Franklin Roosevelt. Roosevelt was aware that antisemitism was not confined to Europe during this time. There was antisemitism in the United States, and the official position that the U.S. government took with regard to World War II and the Holocaust was that the key thing was to defeat Nazi Germany. If you defeated Nazi Germany, then the Holocaust, of course, would come to an end. And people had more knowledge about what was going on with regard to the destruction of the Jewish people in Europe than sometimes was officially acknowledged. But there was a kind of reluctance to take action that would be interpreted as special intervention on behalf of the Jewish people. So that's one factor. The other factor was that, and this has been true since World War II, where genocides are involved, if you acknowledge as a government that something terrible, terrible is happening, then the implication is, well, what are you going to do about it? And to speak openly, to break silence about what is happening in a public way, at least raises the question of intervention, of taking action that would be specifically focused on relieving the suffering and the destructive policies that are affecting a particular group of people. This is often why people are very cautious about using the word genocide to identify an atrocity that's taking place, because the implication would be, okay, if there's an acknowledgement of genocide, then there's a responsibility to react and to protect. So it's interesting, bystanding is not something that pertains only to individual people. It can refer to institutions. to governments. During the Holocaust, we know that the churches were bystanders in some ways. It can refer to institutional behavior as well as to individual personal action or lack of it.
Let me ask you about the decision for a bystander to become a resistor. And certainly in Nazi Germany, that was considered to be a very fraught decision. And there's ample evidence of that result. You look at somebody like Hans and Sophie Scholl, students who published a pamphlet. They were picked up, charged, adjudicated, and executed, you know, judged and executed the same day. But there are episodes where people did resist. In 1943, yep. When Jewish spouses and intermarriages were targeted for deportation, people rose up, the spouses, the, quote, Aryan spouses, and other family members went to the place where they were held, and the Nazi officials relented and released those family members.
Yes, and it's also important to think of people who were rescuers.
Yes.
Your example of the Jewish the spouses in mixed marriages is linked with this. But most of the people who during the Holocaust rescued or helped people, you could say they would be examples of people who probably moved from, you know, some form of onlooking, seeing something that was going on, and being moved to act, to do something, because what they saw struck them as wrong. I mean, it's an ethical, there's an ethical dimension in all of this. Now, the problem is with people who see something going on, then they know it's wrong, and they still don't do anything. But this is where the rescuers become important, because this is a group of people who saw something happening. They saw people being attacked. They saw people suffering. They saw harm being done to people, and they couldn't do everything to stop it. But in many, many cases, they intervened to help somebody, to save someone from harm. And these people are so important as examples for us, because they show what the range of human response and action can be. You can move from being somebody who is standing by to somebody who is intervening. And the ways in which people can intervene to do something to prevent harm doing and suffering are just immense and vast if we put our minds to them.
That's often referred to, I think, as the universe of obligation. And that universe can be very different depending on the individual. It could be someone you know that is seeing this, you're witnessing the injustice against someone you know. But it can also be much larger. It can be to community members. It can be to people within your province or complete strangers.
Yes, absolutely. And I think all of us have some kind of sense of obligation. In many cases, it's maybe only to ourselves. You know, we prize our individual freedom and liberty almost to the exclusion of our responsibility to others sometimes. But it's natural for it to exist in a larger capacity. We all come from families. We all come from communities, and our upbringing creates some sense of loyalty, some sense of obligation, I think, unless we just are totally indifferent to it or suppress it. But the dilemma very often is how do we expand this beyond the tribe, beyond the party, beyond the sense of religious or racial or cultural identity that we care about. And that's always a challenge. But one of the things that can do it, if we allow it to happen, is just the awareness as we look at some activity going on that what we're seeing take place is wrong. that it isn't right or good to beat people up or to burn buildings at random or to arrest people without cause and to throw them into concentration camps. I mean, this is where Kristallnacht and the Holocaust can act for us as a kind of moral compass. If we let history in, if we let history touch us, it can help us have a kind of orientation to the things that are taking place in our present and that might take place in our future.
That obligation you're talking about, it's easy to see it extends to family, it might extend to community, it might extend to other social groups. But as you well know, there's the term for people who are not alien to all those categories, and that's the other. How do we extend that to the other?
Well, this is the perennial human challenge, I think. And there isn't one fixed answer to it. I think what we have to cultivate and care about are the capacities and institutions that have the ability to open our horizons here. This is where education is important. It's where religion of the best kind is important. It's even where patriotism and politics of the right kinds are important, because I think the institutions that exist to support those aspects of our lives, that they have kind of a two-edged sword about them. They can close us down, they can restrict us, but when they work at their best, they can open us up to the other. They can open us up to inclusiveness rather than to exclusion. I think this is what we feel as Americans in some ways. You know, when we are at our best, we stand for rights, for pluralism, for inclusiveness, for justice, and for the hope that we can create, as our founding documents suggest, a more perfect union. So we have resources. The resources are fundamentally ethical and spiritual. They're fragile. They can be overridden. They can be ignored. We can be silent about them. But these are the tools that we have, and they can be quite powerful and potent if we let them into our lives and let them nourish us.
Professor Roth, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, thanks so much. It's been great to be with you, and I appreciate your support for the Kristallnacht observance that's upcoming in Tulsa.
Dr. John Roth is a professor emeritus of philosophy at Claremont McKenna College and a noted Holocaust and genocide researcher. He'll be the guest speaker for the Kristallnacht Remembrance this Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock via Zoom. It is a virtual event on the consequences of being a bystander. To register for the lecture and remembrance, visit jewishtulsa.org and look on the events page. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.